everybody. Thank you to the organizers for inviting me to come and talk about such a beautiful part of the country. So I'm going to talk to you today about a rather old problem in the NMR field, something that was laid down by Bloomergen in the late 1950s, a process that occurs due to the bipolar coupling of nuclear spins in a solid, which results in the spatial transport of spin coherence, a term he coined spin diffusion. So I'm from Brooklyn College. Brooklyn College was lauded to have one of the most beautiful campuses in the United States. Not exactly sure why, but the campus is located here in the heart of Brooklyn, and this is the geography of New York if you're not familiar with it. So here's the outline for my talk. I'll start out with just a simple problem statement. I'll tell you a little bit more details of the spin system. One of the appealing aspects of these crystals in NMR is that we have very precise control over the quantum dynamics. That we can manipulate the dynamics coherently to very high precision. So I'm going to tell you about a method, experimental technique, resulting from a theory that John Waugh developed in the 1960s, termed average Hamiltonian theory, and I'll go into that in a little bit of detail. And I'll tell you a little bit more about spin diffusion using a model, and then the experimental protocol. I'll discuss the results and some conclusions. So, the summary statement of our work, we'd like to explore how spin diffusion evolves a well-defined microscopic property, a spin state, in the long-time many-body limit. So the system that we're looking at is calcium fluoride. Calcium fluoride at room temperature is below the Debye temperature. The Debye temperature is about 520 Kelvin. The crystals often come in a variety of colors. The color results from free electrons that are sparse in the samples that we study.
So the different colors somehow come because of just different
paramagnetic states. Different paramagnetic impurities, different electrons. So the spin of interest is the fluorine spins. Calcium is a low abundance. The fluorine spins have a spin 1/2. They couple to each other via the familiar dipolar coupling. So just to put everyone on the same page, we have the spins coupled. There's an angular dependence in the coupling, which I'll tell you more about in a little bit. There's a radial dependence. And this term here in the dipolar coupling, the so-called flip-flop term, results in the spatial transport of spin coherence. It's this term that we're interested in studying, how this term propagates a well-defined microscopic property, that is the spin state, in the macroscopic limit. Okay, so very simply put, we have the flip-flop term. So make sure everyone's on the same page. What can happen with the spatial propagation of the spin coherence is you can have coherence on one spin, say spin I propagating through to spin J via the flip-flop mechanism. Okay, this is one of the possible mechanisms, one of the possible results that results from the flip-flop transition.
Could you say again, what is the spin of this I?
So the spin I refers to the fluorine spins. Their spin half is the I. Okay, so I'd like to talk to you for a little bit about average Hamiltonian theory. This theory was something that was developed in the 1960s by Waugh, Huber, and Haberlin. Mostly it was John Waugh's idea. this paper that was published in the 1960s really transformed the way people did NMR. Okay. So the essence of the idea, which is what I'll go through in a few minutes, is that you can manipulate the coherent evolution of the spin systems by applying a well-defined radio frequency pulse sequence. And so I'm going to go through two examples with you. But what I thought I would do first is highlight some of the results that was shown in the PRL paper, which I have down here, referenced down at the bottom, that will give you a taste of what the theory allows you to do in magnetic resonance. So here you have the NMR signal in the time domain. This is amplitude versus time. And you have two signals here. The sample here was a sample of calcium fluoride suspended in fluorotoluene. Okay. So you have...
I just missed something. So what's your zero in time? What do you mean by the last signal?
Okay, so right at this instant here, at time t equals zero, pi over two pulse is applied that excites the nuclear spins. The magnetization is brought into the transverse plane, and the magnetization is detected inductively with an RF coil in the usual fashion. So here you see the induced voltage, the amplitude is related to the induced voltage in the RF coil. So here you have amplitude versus time. So there's two signals here. One is a very fast decaying signal from the solid, and then a very slow decaying signal from the liquid. The very fast decaying signal from the solid is due to the strong dipolar coupling. The spin dephases much quicker than the liquid, resulting in a very rapid decay. Okay. On the right, I have the Fourier transform of the signal. The broad signal is resulting from the calcium fluoride. The sharp line is from the fluorotoluene. Okay. Okay, now, without going through too many details, what was presented in this 1960s paper was a pulse sequence that effectively turned off the homonuclear dipolar coupling in calcium fluoride. Okay. So a pulse sequence was applied, and I'll tell you more about the details in just one or two slides, that allowed for a measurement of the chemical shift of the fluorine spins in the liquid and in the solid. So I want to bring to your attention the scale here. Here we have kilohertz, and the scale goes from minus 20 to 20 kilohertz. Here we have the solid line, which was broad, now narrowed to approximately half a kilohertz. So we have, in effect, turned off the dipolar coupling in the solid. Okay? So in the time domain here, again, a pi over 2 pulse was applied, and the NMR signal was detected inductively in the usual fashion. And the Fourier transform of this signal, you have the fluorotoluene signal and the calcium fluoride signal.
So the residual width remaining, yep, is that due to dipolar coupling, or is that due to somehow homogeneity
was a sample? Okay, so I'll come back to your question in a few minutes, but let me say for the moment that the residual width in the solid is due to not only field inhomogeneity, but also things like pulse artifacts.
Okay. It just strikes me as accidental, that the residual width of the liquid line and the residual width of the solid line, I mean, the width of the liquid line, which is presumably very homogeneous, mm-hmm, the very homogeneous substance is sort of comparable to the width of the solid line.
Right.
Meaning, so that somehow hints at experimental artifacts.
So you would have liked them to have been exactly the same?
No, I would have liked them. I would have expected them that they would be different because they're very different systems.
So we with the pulse sequence, we turn off the dipolar coupling. And you notice, by the way, it's approximately a three order of magnitude reduction in the line width, right? Okay. So what's important that I communicate to you here is that this experimental technique that was developed by Wah, Huber, and Haberlin really transformed the way people thought about doing NMR. Prior to this technique, there was no hope for resolving chemical shifts in solids. The goal of NMR spectroscopy, one goal of NMR spectroscopy, is to make a measurement of a chemical shift. It gives you information about the local environment. This experimental technique allowed you to do that. Okay, so average Hamiltonian theory is a well-known established method of controlling how a system evolves under a desired effective Hamiltonian by manipulating the dynamics with an experimentally controllable time-dependent Hamiltonian. An NMR, that's the RF pulse that we have control over. It's not tied to NMR, although NMR is very suitable for its application. The theory has been used both in spectroscopy and imaging, and also now has been applied in quantum information processing. Okay, so let me summarize the concept of average Hamiltonian theory with the simple schematic. The idea in the formalism is to replace a sequence of RF pulses, which I've denoted by these blue bars, which we have control over, and periods of free evolution between the pulses where the system might evolve under a chemical shift interaction, a local dipolar interaction, a quadrupolar interaction, any Hamiltonian, replace the sequence of pulses and free evolution by a time-independent effective Hamiltonian. The effective Hamiltonian transforms the state from t equals zero to time t equals capital T, but doesn't say anything about what the state of the system is during the pulse train. So the experiments, before I move on to the next slide, the experiments are performed stroboscopically. That is, you don't sample continuously in time, although we never do that in NMR because we do it with a digitizer. We sample at well-defined intervals of time. Those intervals of time are controlled by us, the experimenter. Okay, I'm going to go through a few equations that are used in the analysis because I'm going to make reference to them later on. So we have an ensemble. The spins are in a strong magnetic field. Okay. The spin system is described by a density matrix. The time evolution of the density matrix is given by, in the average Hamiltonian theory, is given by the following equation. We have a propagator, U internal, and a propagator that describes the sequence of RF pulses, which I've denoted URF. URF is given by what's known as the Dyson series, which many of you know, and U internal is given by what's known as the Magnus expansion. This Magnus expansion has a sum of terms here in the exponent. The first term and the second term I've written here. Now the first term, you might notice, looks like the average of a Hamiltonian. That is, you integrate over time and divide by time. That's where the average Hamiltonian term comes from. It's because the first term, or the zeroth order term, looks like the average of some quantity. Okay. The Hamiltonian here has a tilde on it. This is the so-called toggling frame Hamiltonian. It is the Hamiltonian in the frame of reference of the RF pulses. Okay. That is, we apply a sequence of RF pulses, and we ask the question, how does the Hamiltonian transform in the frame of reference of the applied RF pulses?
Excuse me. It's not clear to me why for the RF Hamiltonian you use the Dyson expansion and for the internal Hamiltonian you use the Magnus. In principle, we can use the same expansion for both.
You can. It just turns out to be more convenient in the analysis when you work it out. Either one works. The one appealing aspect of the theory, which Vadim alluded to, is that a variety of Hamiltonians, which we encounter as experimentalists, such as pulse errors, the fact that you may want to give a 90-degree pulse, but after many, many pulses, if your flip angle's off by 1 degree, that significantly impacts the time evolution of the syncytion. With pulse transients, the fact that, for example, we apply kilowatts of RF through an inductive coil, and that inductive coil has an induced EMF, and it rings, these effects plague the efficiency of the multiple pulse sequence. We also have finite pulse width effects. For example, like the spin system evolves under the both the dipolar interaction and the RF interaction during the applied RF pulses. We can account for these errors in the formalism. Okay, so let me go through a very simple example, something that I think all of you are familiar with, the famous Hahn echo sequence, where you apply a pi pulse and you can refocus magnetization. That is, you apply pi, you apply a 90 degree pulse, you wait for some time, the spins dephase, then a pi pulse is applied, you wait for an additional time, tau, and the magnetization is brought back to life in the sense that you refocus the signal in, and you detect it inductively again. Okay, so we're going to consider for this purpose, for this example, two identical spins in the presence of a chemical shift or field inhomogeneity. The Hamiltonians for these two interactions are essentially identical, and the dipolar interaction. Okay, so what I just want to go through this very quickly with you, if you consider the chemical shift interaction for the two spins, it scales as a constant times IZ1 plus IZ2. If you go through the analysis for the toggling frame Hamiltonians, the sign of the Hamiltonians flipped because of the pi pulse. As a consequence, the sum of these two interactions, when you do the integral over the entire cycle, is zero. That's the leading term of the Magnus expansion. For the dipolar interaction, however, because you have the product of two operators, IZ1, IZ2, the pi pulse does not affect the sign of the Hamiltonian. As a consequence, the integration over this entire sequence results in twice the dipole interaction. So what does this mean, physically?
Are you missing omega dipoles in certain terms?
Am I missing what?
Omega dipole on the second term.
Oh, it's multiplying everything, sorry. There's parentheses there that I'm missing. There. Omega D multiplies everything. Yeah, the three, yeah, that's a typo. Yeah, I need to fix that. Okay, thank you. So if the system is sampled at an interval 2 tau here, it would appear to have evolved under an effective Hamiltonian, which is twice the dipolar interaction, and the chemical interaction is, in a sense, turned off. Okay, so I'm getting to the techniques that we use to actually measure spin diffusion now. In calcium fluoride, the line width along the 001 direction is approximately 48 kilohertz. There's a pulse sequence that was developed by Rim, Pines, and Waugh in this paper, which was rejected. John Waugh told me it was rejected several times from PhysRev because the reviewers told them that the paper reports on a violation of the spin temperature hypothesis, which was a sort of a fundamental theory in the NMR field in the 1960s and 70s. But what this paper showed was that you can refocus the dynamics of dipolar coupled spins, something that was not really shown prior to this paper. So this pulse sequence, which I'll show you on the next slide, has an effective Hamiltonian, which is minus half HD. It's a leading order of the Magnus expansion. Okay, so the pulse sequence looks like this, and I'm not going to go through the entire analysis. You have a period of free evolution, then a period of RF pulses that are applied. These are phases. So you have a pi over 2 y, and then an X pulse turned on for some time, 2 tau. Then you flip the phase of the RF to minus X, and then there's another pi over 2 pulse applied, and then another period of free evolution. So the toggling frame Hamiltonians here are HD, the dipolar coupling, minus HD over 2, and then HD, if you do the integration for the leading order term of the Magnus expansion, you get 0. So under this cycle, the system appears to not have evolved under the many-body dipolar interaction.
Can I just ask, so you're talking about leading order in these expansions. Is there some small parameter which says that you can forget about the higher orders?
That's a very good question. Experimentally, and the theory actually shows that the higher order terms scale as 1 over omega RF, where omega RF is the strength of the RF, the applied RF field. So if you turn on the RF field in this pulse sequence and make the strength of the RF field infinite, the higher order terms vanish. But the question of the convergence of the magnetic expansion in multiple pulse NMR is something that was answered by Matty Marik. It's a paper that he published. And what are the experimental conditions that one needs to satisfy to achieve convergence? It's a question that really any multiple pulse sequence we apply in NMR is plagued by this limiting condition that you have to achieve convergence in the magnetic expansion. That is to say that the calculation that, for example, I've shown here is a leading order sort of a calculation to leading order. And all the pulse sequences have different conditions in terms of what needs to be implemented to satisfy convergence of the magnetic expansion. So some pulse sequences, for example, the one I showed you early on that was published by Wahuber and Haberlin, the so-called Wahuha sequence, requires that the pulses, the pi over 2 pulses, are of finite duration, that is that they're delta function RF pulses. And if you move away from this condition, the pulse sequence just doesn't perform well. The convergence of the magnetic expansion is not achieved.
I mean, I don't want to slow you down if it's not a relevant point, but...
Well, it's a very relevant point.
I'd have thought, in principle, you might not care about...
No, we do care.
...of the magnetic expansion because, although it would be more complicated to calculate, presumably, in principle, you could go beyond the magnetic expansion or think about all orders and still imagine designing a pulse sequence with finite field strength and finite durations and so on, but so there, what you wanted for the...
So there are conditions, there are symmetry conditions. You can be very creative in the design of the pulse sequence, and there are symmetry conditions that one can impose on a sequence that will cancel all the odd or even order terms of the magnetic expansion. So you can play some tricks in the design of the pulse sequence. You can do such things, yeah.
But I think it is fair to say that most people start with a zeroth order. If there's something interesting, they do the experiment. If it works, they see.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been frustrating to me because when I read the plans, it's sort of like flying by the seat of the pants. So in particular, what you're suggesting, doing sort of a more sort of systematic flow K type analysis, is not often done, it seems, to people. I mean, even going to whatever third order in the magnetic expansion is pretty laborious.
Yeah, the calculations are laborious because you have those commutators. Okay, so the effect of Hamiltonian, as I just said, is often limited by pulse transients, finite pulse widths, pulse errors. And I told you average Hamiltonian theory allows you to account for these errors. And the idea is that you can design supercycles that remove the contribution and then implement a desired transformation. So what I did in my work relating to spin diffusion is that we considered effects like finite pulse widths, pulse flip errors, and symmetric transients. And when you account for these errors, you find that you can improve the efficiency of the line narrowing, that is the ability to turn off the many-body interaction very efficiently. And I'll show you the results in a minute. Okay, so if you account for the finite pulse widths, that is that the RF pulse that we applied is not a delta function pulse. That is that this pi over 2 pulse is not a delta function pulse. This calculation that I've shown here assumes that those pi over 2 pulses are delta functions. If you account for the pi over 2 pulses, there's a contributing term that scales as a constant alpha, which is related to the pulse width, times this term. If you apply a pulse train that does not correct for these pulse width errors, the resulting line narrowing is around 360 hertz, which is still very good. Remember, we went from 48 kilohertz to 361 hertz. The idea is that now, if you know how the finite pulse widths contribute to one magic echo, in the next magic echo that you can apply, you can undo the unwanted pulse error and then build up a supercycle that cancels those errors. If you do that, and I've shown you schematically how this concept works, you apply a pulse with a finite pulse width contribution that scales as plus alpha times some spin operators, and then you apply a pulse where you've changed the phases of the RF in a well-defined way to flip the sign of the error, and then you make a measurement over this cycle, this larger supercycle, the resulting line narrowing efficiency is half a hertz. We went from 48 kilohertz to half a hertz. So what I'm trying to communicate here is that calcium fluoride is really an ideal testbed for many body theory, that we have control over the interaction Hamiltonian to very high precision.
Okay, can I just ask a quick question?
Yeah.
So the values of RF field strength and the effective parameter, the alpha, how large is that?
So the pulse width that we used, from my recollection, was about 2 microseconds, which
right.
is typically what's used in solid state NMR.
But what is the value of alpha?
So alpha would be half a microsecond. It's related to alpha's.
It doesn't have the right unit.
Yeah, it doesn't have the right unit. So alpha is related to something that scales as well. It's going to be, let's see.
Somehow the impression I had that alpha was small, but its effect over the time of the pulse somehow.
Alpha is related to the pulse width. I may not have the exact units here correctly, but the concept here is that you flip the sign.
Right.
But the pulse width, to answer your first question, the pulse width we use were about 2 microseconds, which is what's typical in NMR. Okay. All right, so what I just went through, I showed you how we can coherently manipulate spin dynamics in NMR using average Hamiltonian theory. I'm going to go through a little bit of a discussion on spin diffusion on the lattice and how we actually measured spin diffusion. So you remember, I told you we have an interaction Hamiltonian which has a constant that has an angular dependence and radial dependence. And there's a term in the interaction Hamiltonian that results in spatial transport of spin coherence, this so-called flip-flop mechanism. And I told you previously that this flip-flop mechanism can transport magnetization from one spin to its dipolar coupled neighbor.
You say neighbor, but it's 1 over R cubed, right?
So. Yeah. There's a 1 over R cubed.
That's still the last of the future.
Yeah. Any dipolar couple neighbor, not just nearest neighbors. So the two spin states that we were interested in measuring is what the NMR community refers to as a Zeeman ordered state and a dipolar ordered state. So the Zeeman ordered state, we have a density matrix that in the high temperature, high field limit scales as epsilon times the sum over IZ sub I. IZ, I here's the spin on the, refers to the each individual spin, right? And then we can create via RF pulses in the NMR field, we can create via RF pulses what's known as a dipolar ordered state, and the dipolar ordered state scales as a constant times the dipolar interaction. So this is a correlated state. It's a state where the spins are coupled, correlated to each other.
What do you mean the states scales as a G?
I'm sorry?
What do you mean the dipolar ordered state scales as HD?
What I mean is that the dipolar ordered state is a constant times HD. In the community, we typically ignore the identity because we have no control over it. So we don't consider the identity in any of our analysis. So what I mean by scales, I mean is it's a constant times HD.
As an operator, the density matrix is, the density matrix is corrected from the identity by the single spin operator, whereas this is somehow correlated spin.
So are you always in a high temperature regime?
Like yeah. In the experiments I'm showing you here, we're always in a high temperature regime. Everything was done at room temperature. Okay, so what I'm going to go through here is now a toy model of spin diffusion. And the purpose of the model is for me to communicate to you the method of measurement, highlight some of the salient features of spin diffusion on a lattice, but I do not want to predict a spin diffusion rate. Yeah? Okay, so let's follow the evolution for a single polarized spin. This is the condition we have very often at the high temperature, high field limit. We have a single polarized spin with its neighbors unpolarized. So we have spin J polarized with the neighbors unpolarized. Epsilon here is related to the field and inversely related to the temperature. By the action of an applied pulsed field gradient, what we can do is write a spatially dependent phase on the sample. That is that we apply a pulsed field gradient that encodes a phase on the polarized spin. That phase is related to the applied field gradient by gamma, which is the nuclear gyromagnetic ratio, times the gradient, dB by dz, times t. T here is the time of the gradient pulse. The phase phi is given by k. K is a wave number. It has units of 1 over units of distance, 1 over centimeters or 1 over meters. And z sub j refers to the position of the jth spin.
Sorry, could you just say what this capital E plus is?
Yeah, so capital E plus, I had it back here, is just the, I think it's referred to as the idempotent, or it's the, just indicates that the spin is polarized.
Right, okay. Yeah.
In order to encode the phase, what's done experimentally, which I'm highlighting here with this simple analysis, is that we apply a pulse train of magic echoes that turn off the dipolar coupling. This effectively suspends spin diffusion as well, because we turn off HD completely. In the experiment, we then, after writing this phase on the sample, we evolve under HD for a variable experimentally controlled time, tau. What happens experimentally in the spin system is that the polarization can move through the flip-flop mechanism from the jth spin to a dipolar coupled neighbor, say the L spin. We apply a gradient pulse with the amplitude of the gradient flipped, so that's what's denoted here by the minus sign, that encodes a negative phase on the sample. Because the spin is now, the coherence in this model has now moved from J to L, we have phi sub L here rather than phi sub J. I'm just rewriting that over here now, the propagation of the spin coherence can move to any dipolar coupled neighbor. So that's what's denoted here by a sum over k. In NMR, when we detect the signal, we perform the trace of rho with iz. As a consequence, when you do the average of iz over the sample, this sum, the odd order terms in this exponential cancel in the limit of delta phi being random. and small, and the spread of this phase that's encoded on the sample is expected to behave diffusively by a diffusion constant, d.
Can I neglect that the spin splits into many spins, so to speak? That you distribute over many sides simultaneously?
Can you?
I mean, you only consider that you go from side A to side L, but not to L and K and N.
You go to all spins. That's what's intended by the sum here.
In the superposition, there's only one spin at the time that is not you. It's a bit like a single particle.
I think what you're envisioning is that some of the coherence can move from one spin and some of it can move to another dipolar couple neighbor. Is that what you're...
Yeah, then somehow you can split, or is that forbidden by some conservation laws?
And one is symmetric elements between a state that spins somewhere and spins in two different places.
Yeah, of course, we can have situations like that with the flip-flop mechanism, but I'm not, the purpose of what I'm showing you here is just to articulate what's happening in the sample, not go through all of the many-body behavior. Yes.
Doesn't the fact that the density matrix is so close to the identity give you a small parameter? I mean, I have a feeling that what you're talking about would be higher order.
Higher order in what parameter?
Well, essentially this epsilon that's in the density matrix.
Yeah, okay. Sure.
But the dipolar coupling would allow coherence. What I'm showing here in this model, let me see if I can articulate this. What I'm showing here in this model, in the first step of spin diffusion, that all of the coherence moves from one spin to another, is a fiction. It's not really the only thing that can happen. There are many, many choices.
Well, at short times, this is pretty good. I mean, I think the point is that deviation from identity is almost an identity. It's basically identity on all sides. So if you operate with S plus, S minus, that doesn't create these correlated states. It's certainly not an issue.
Sure, yes.
It's a toy problem.
Okay, so let me... should tell you a little bit now about what happens with the dipolar ordered state. So again, we start with this polarization on the jth spin. We've encoded a phase on that spin. And through the action of pulse sequences that are well known in the NMR community, there are two choices that we have. One is known as an adiabatic demagnetization field, where you apply an RF pulse and you adiabatically turn off the pulse. The nuclear spins then align along their local field in the rotating frame. Okay. That's known as an ADRF pulse sequence. There's also a pulsed version of that developed by Junier and Brocard, which is coined the Junier-Brocard sequence for developing dipolar order in solids. It's a two-pulse sequence that converts Zeeman order to a dipolar order. So we can create a state like this between spins J and K. That is, that we can create a state that scales as a constant times the dipolar coupling. Then we evolve under the dipolar coupling for a control time tau. The dipolar order can spread from spins J and K to, for example, spins L and M. And going back to your question, this is one of many possibilities that's available to you through the dipolar coupling. So I'm just repeating the same expression here. In the experiment, we have to convert back to Zeeman order in order to perform a measurement. We convert this state back to Zeeman order using a remagnetizing field. The phase now here is spread on spins J. polarization those on spins L and M. When we apply negative gradients, and again we combine this with the multiple pole sequence that essentially suspends spin diffusion for the purpose of writing the undoing the phase on the sample, we have this phase difference, phi sub j minus phi sub l. And again, we have to do the measurement, we have to do a trace over rho times iz, and because the spread is over all spins, there's a sum here over all L and M. So in the long time, any spin limit delta phi is small and random. The spread of the initial phase is expected to behave diffusively, and as a consequence, delta phi squared can be written as a constant times k times d times tau, and there's a factor of 2 here that comes from the fact that you have the dipolar ordered state. So let me summarize. For the dipolar order, there's a factor of 2 that's implied by our model, the simple toy model, that says that the spread of dipolar order should go faster than that of Zeeman order. The spin system is actually more complex, and again, the purpose of this toy model was just to bring to light what we're doing in the experiment, how we actually do the experiment with pulsed field gradients. Okay, let me tell you a little bit about the protocol, how we actually did the experiments. The spin diffusion rate is predicted to be very slow, so Bloombergen provides a back of the envelope calculation that says spin diffusion rate in calcium fluoride is on the order of 10 to the minus 12 centimeters squared per second. This is very slow, so in about an hour, spin coherence moves only about a micron. In order to make a measurement, what's required is that we spatially encode a profile, that is a spatially dependent phase, whose wavelength is on this length scale in order to probe the dynamics. In addition, the attenuation due to spin diffusion needs to be larger than that due to relaxation. In calcium fluoride, the nuclear spins relax via paramagnetic sites, which we can't control. That's not part of the experiment of interest. What we're interested in probing is the coherent evolution of the spin dynamics and how spin diffusion propagates magnetization through the sample. The attenuation here due to diffusion, in order for us to actually make a measurement, needs to be larger than, for example, T1 or T1D. In our crystals, the T1 can range from minutes to months, depending on the degree of paramagnetic sites. In order to create these profiles, this encoded wave magnetization with a wavelength on the order of a micron, the samples need to be very small. So our samples were about a millimeter cubed. And so the precision that's required to encode and then refocus the magnetization is on the order of about 1 part in 10 to the fifth. So that required some engineering of the electronics and the gradient, which I'll show you in a minute. So what's done to actually encode this profile, we turn off the dipolar coupling using average Hamiltonian methods, and then we apply very short, strong pulse field gradients in well-defined times of the multiple pulse train. So we have an RF train that's suspending spin diffusion, and during the free evolution times, we apply a pulse field gradient. The gradient Hamiltonian and the dipolar Hamiltonian commute with each other, so the evolution can be considered separable. So what we did was we improved the radio frequency pulse sequence for controlling the nuclear spin degrees of freedom, so we accounted for all the pulse errors and RF transients. This is something I already told you about. We applied pulse field gradients to this sample with a home-built probe that we built in-house. The design of the RF coil was also very important. Things like RF and homogeneity typically plague the multiple pulse sequence, and things like this needed to be very carefully accounted for. The amount of current that we delivered through the coil was on the order of about 25 to 50 amps, and the duration of the pulses was between 20 and 30 microseconds. The reproducibility of the pulsed gradient needed to be less than 1 part in 10 to the fifth in order to actually perform the measurement. So the gradient set, this is not commercial stuff that you can buy off the shelf from Bruker or Varian. We designed a gradient. The idea here is that this is a cross section of the gradient set. These are copper wires that are wound around a machined piece of plastic. The sample fits here. Then you have the RF coil that's wrapped around the sample. This is a picture of the actual experimental setup. The sample fits in this tiny little hole right here. The dimensions of that hole are about, the diameter is about 2 millimeters or 1.7 millimeters. And then you have about 150 turns of copper wires. Those copper wires are laid out in a well-defined way to create a homogeneous gradient through the sample. That is a dB by dZ with all the higher order terms, dB by dZ squared and so on, zero. And the technique to do that is something that was laid out by Swoetz and Wilkin in this paper down here. And then there's some other techniques that are laid out in this paper by Zhang and Corey. Okay, so now I'm going to show you some of the experimental results and some of the theoretical predictions for diffusion of Zeeman order and diffusion of dipolar order. So for the next few slides, D sub Z refers to the Zeeman order diffusion rate. D sub B refers to the diffusion rate of dipolar order. T1 and T1D refer to the relaxation times of Zeeman and dipolar order, respectively. Well, the quality of this is quite poor. I don't know if you guys can make out some of the symbols here. Okay, so on the left I have the experimental measurement of the Zeeman diffusion rate for two crystalline orientations. That would be crystalline orientation with the, on the top we have the 111 direction aligned with the Zeeman field, and on the bottom we have the 001 direction aligned with the magnetic field. The different experimental points here, the squares, the circles, and the triangles, refer to different values of K, which are summarized in the caption here. What's shown here on the data are the attenuation, logarithmically, the attenuation due to spin diffusion as a function of delta. Delta is the diffusion time. What the data reveal is that the diffusion rate is independent of K, that is the encoded profile in the sample. The slope of the line is the diffusion coefficient. On the right, we have the diffusion measurement for dipolar order. Again, what I have are different experimental points, squares, triangles, and circles, which are the value of the pulse gradient field that was applied to the sample. Here, which is kind of blurred, I don't know why the quality is so poor, this is the value of K in inverse millimeters. So the value of K ranged from about 2 micron to half a micron in order to be sensitive to the attenuation to spin diffusion. Let's see if I wanted to say
natural log or base 10?
So this is just the log of the magnetization.
Natural log.
Natural log, yeah.
And so, sorry, one more thing. So can you see T1 here? Oh, the T1 is included in the log.
So we take off the attenuation due to T1 and T1D respectively.
You can measure that separately.
Yeah, I should say that. So what was done in the experiment is before these experiments are done, we do a measurement of T1. T1D in the usual fashion. So just measure the relaxation. Okay, so here I've summarized our experimental measurements for the two orientations. I have the Zeeman diffusion rate, the dipolar diffusion rate, and then the relaxation times. So I'm just going to talk for the next 10 minutes about these measurements and compare them with some theoretical predictions. So without going through too many details, we have a moment calculation that was performed by Redfield and Yu in the 1960s, which predicts the Zeeman diffusion rate to be on the order of 10 to the minus 12 centimeters squared per second. And for the two orientations, a difference, right? And that difference is due to the angular anisotropy in the dipolar coupling, which I'll remind you of. I'll do that in the next slide. So the ratio of these two numbers is predicted to be 1.222. Borkmans and Walgreth did a calculation using irreversible statistical mechanics. They also showed that there's an angular variation in the diffusion rate, and the number they computed is about 1.4. Tang and Wah simulated classical gyromagnets in the early 90s. I should say that Dan Sodikson also did a simulation of classical gyromagnets in the late 90s. I don't have that data here. For the 001 direction, the number was predicted 7.43, 10 to the minus 12 centimeters squared per second. There's no data for the 111 direction. I think there was a problem with convergence in the simulation. As far as I know, they had some problem with the stability or something, I can't quite remember. Recently, a colleague of mine with my mentor, Dave Corey, did a calculation using a hydrodynamic approach where they predicted 8.1 and 7.4 with a ratio of 1.1. So our experimental measurements are in good agreement. We measured 1.4 times plus or minus 0.2. This is not the first measurement of the spin diffusion rate of Zeeman order. There's a measurement that was performed prior to my measurements by Wurong Zhang and David Corey, which showed similar experimental results. So the ratio of the diffusion coefficients and the relaxation times reflect the local anisotropy. You remember I showed you on the previous two slides that the T1 has an angular variation. That's due to the local dipolar coupling. And so we measured 1.4 plus or minus 0.2. The ratio of the T1s is about 1.1 plus or minus 0.1. And this variation is due to this anisotropy in the dipolar coupling. So there's been a few calculations for the diffusion of dipolar order. Borkmans and Walgreth's calculation showed that the diffusion of dipolar order is very close to Zeeman order. The calculations showed that the numbers are 8.5 and 7.4 with a ratio of about 1.1. The classical simulation of Tang and Wah showed that the diffusion of dipolar order is much faster, well, maybe a factor of 2, from the Zeeman order, 13.3. Again, no data on the 111 direction. Dan Greenbaum's recent calculation using the hydrodynamic approach indicates an angular anisotropy between the two orientations, 001 and 111, but they predicted a much faster rate than Zeeman order, 19.1. 11.4, with a ratio of diffusion of dipolar order to Zeeman order to be about 2.35. Our experimental data seem to reveal that the diffusion of dipolar order is significantly faster than that of Zeeman order. We measured a 4.5 for the 001, and for the 111, 7.5. The ratio of the two numbers, 001 and 111, are similar. We seem to find that the numbers are close to 1. The ratio is close to 1. So I'll give you a physical picture for why that's true in just a minute. So I've just summarized here these numbers. Again, the diffusion of dipolar order to Zeeman order for the 001, 111 direction, and then the ratio of the two numbers. The spin diffusion rate of dipolar order is isotropic with respect to crystalline orientation, and the differences in the spin diffusion rate of dipolar order to Zeeman order do not account for the differences in the corresponding relaxation times. And this might indicate that other processes are involved, something that Vadim and I are now beginning to explore, perhaps a phonon interaction.
Do you know how perfect is your single crystal of that?
Oh, we're pretty confident that what we were looking at was a single crystal of calcium fluoride. The way you can tell is by just looking at the NMR line shape. The FID is something that you can easily measure in NMR, and there have been various predictions for the shape of the FID, and it's pretty well known, kind of textbook, what the FID for the two orientations should look like.
Are there some neutron measurements, say, inelastic neutron scattering on such kind of single crystal? Because you have a cubic millimeter, which is sufficient for doing inelastic neutrons.
There's no X-rays. They line up their crystals with X-rays.
Yeah, very simple way. One of the ways that I oriented my crystal was by just doing the Lowry diffraction. But the easiest way to do it in NMR is just look at the FID. The FID.
No, I'm asking other neutron data for this.
I have never bothered to look and see if there's any neutron data, but I'm sure that there probably are.
What do you want to know with neutrons?
The elastic scattering of what?
Do they scatter?
Scattering neutrons against nuclear spins.
But the energy, the energy is very small.
Yeah, I understand that. In principle, it's doable.
No. No, the energy scale is.
So let me have just a few more slides left, and two more slides left. So once again, the difference in the spin diffusion rate of dipolar order to Zeeman order doesn't reflect the difference in the corresponding relaxation times. And here I've just said maybe some other processes are involved. I do want to remind you, however, that the ratio of, where do I have it? The ratio of the diffusion rates for the Zeeman order are approximately 1.4 plus or minus 0.2. That's very close to the ratio of the relaxation times, the T1 for the 001 and 111 direction. So I only have a few minutes left, and I'd like to provide you with a simple schematic that highlights why diffusion of dipolar order is less quenched. That is, why is it that it should proceed faster? So I gave you some insight to that in the toy model that I showed you. Let me leave you with maybe a schematic as well. For diffusion of Zeeman order, if you have two spins, spins 1 and 2 must undergo a flip-flop. If spins 1 and 2 are initially in the same state, for example, both up or both down, no evolution can take place. For the case of dipolar order, the situation is a bit more complex. That is that there are two possibilities. Both spins 1 and 3 and 2 and 4 can flip-flop, or spins 1 and 2 and 3 and 4 can flip. Even if states 3 and 4 are initially up and down, two different evolution paths are present. Spins 1 and 2 can flip, and 3 and 4 can flip, or spins 1 and 4 and 2 and 3 can flip. So this simple, let me just add another comment here. This, the fact that you have more options for flipping in the dipolar ordered state also seems you can envision would also quench the angular anisotropy in the diffusion rate. That's more apparent in the case of Zeeman order. Yeah.
So these sort of short times, if you like, cartoons, they're presumably accounted for in the theoretical studies and simulations. So why are you suggesting that somehow? Well, I'm not sure. I mean, are you saying that somehow there's something missed in the simulations, or?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't have an answer for what was done in the simulation just because I haven't done them, but I think maybe that's something that we maybe should revisit.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. run out of time, so let me just draw some conclusions. So the spin diffusion rate of a two-spin correlated state was in single crystal calcium fluoride was measured using conventional pulse gradient schemes. These techniques of applying pulse gradients to encode a phase on a sample are the technique people use in the NMR field to measure molecular diffusion in liquids, for example. What was new was the strong pulse field gradients combined with the multiple pulse sequences. Well, not new, but this is what was used in these measurements. We implemented coherent averaging techniques to correct for a variety of pulse errors in the magic echo, resulting in more accurate control of the nuclear spin degrees of freedom. And the techniques are not only applicable for these scattering measurements for measuring diffusion, but are also applicable for spectroscopy and imaging. The methodology here that I've shown you allows for further tests of many body physics, for example, spin diffusion as a function of polarization and or dimensionality. So let me just conclude with acknowledging who helped me do this work. First and foremost, my mentor, Dave Corey, and John Law at MIT. There were a number of people in the lab that really helped me to do these measurements, in particular, Jun Cho and Sekar Ramanathan, and all these other people I've listed here, especially Wu Rong, who's now employed by Bruker, Joe Emerson, Marco, Evan, Nicholas, Paola, helped me significantly with a number of very useful discussions. And maybe I should just mention at the end that we do expect to have a postdoc position available in May, depending on how much NSF likes me and decides to fund me. And if you're interested, my contact information is there. Thank you.
In the 50s, there was this question of why is there spin diffusion at all? That inspired Anderson to come up with this localization paper. There was this point. Do you see any of complications of actually conserving energy, and that there could be localization in your system, or is it too clean, or do you know when these problems arise? Or is there too much inelastic scattering from some source which makes this localization not appear?
I think my measurements don't say anything about the localization. And let me try to articulate why. The time scale over which we do our measurements are on the order of about seconds. And so if the localization, if it occurs, it's a process that I think happens on the time scales of something like 1/Bq or a couple of them, so very short times that we can't measure with these scattering schemes. So I'm not sure I can say anything about whether or not it occurs or whether or not our measurements are actually insensitive to it. Over the time scale that we measure spin diffusion with this experimental technique, we're not sensitive. I don't think we're sensitive to these effects.
One of the problems that I think that one was to look at. See, the trouble with calcium fluoride is that it has no disorder. And you don't expect localization and stuff. So we proposed to look for materials that would have disorder and may have localization, but those are. Right, I mean, there's no disorder, so you don't expect localization.
Yeah, the only disorder in our crystals are these paramagnetic sites, these vacancies. They're very sparse, on the order of 1 in a million, maybe, and less. So.
If there is no disorder, as we assume, so obviously there will be no localization, but then the diffusion is limited by inelastic scattering rate, and the latter should depend on temperature. So my question is, what is the temperature? No?
So dipolar charge is very
only on the direction. So the temperature is negligible. Did you see any temperature dependence of the diffusion?
So we haven't performed any measurements of as a function of temperature. It's something that Vadim and I are now thinking about and looking at. If you look at the NMR line shape in calcium chloride, the FID, there's no temperature dependence in this line shape. That is the spread of single quantum, single spin coherence to multiple spin, single quantum coherence. There's no temperature dependence, only a very large temperature range from 4 Kelvin all the way to room temperature. If you look at the T1, however, there's a very strong temperature dependence, and that was something that Bloomberg showed in his original work. That temperature dependence comes from the temperature dependence of the relaxation times of the paramagnetic sites, not the dipole, the nuclear state.
Because I think in principle all this question about spin diffusion in this system due to the interaction, because you mentioned of whether or not this interacting system can perform as a bus to itself. So,
what do you mean by that? Perform as a bath?
Because if it performs as a bus to itself, then obviously it can produce some inelastic scattering which sets up the diffusion.
No, I'm asking, can I translate back and forth? Yeah, so I think theoretically the easiest thing to say is this. Let's take a rigid lattice. No disorder, no anything.
Yes.
They correlate, the temperature scale on which this spin system becomes correlated is inaccessible of Earth. It's nanokelvins. Mm-hmm. So that's first step. So the intrinsic correlation temperature is irrelevant for you always.
What do you mean by this? What is this called?
So the dipolar coupling converted to kelvins.
Oh, I see.
Okay. It's very, very small.
Okay.
It's, so any temperature difference that you hope to see must be from breaking that approximation of a rigid lattice and so on and so forth. So the sorts of things that we're interested in now is to actually ask, can there be spin photon effects? Because photons are very much temperature dependent.
I'd say two things. One quick thing. So the timescales that you're probing here, can I just check? They're shorter than the
seconds. T1. Seconds to minutes.
And the T1 is longer than that. Yeah. Okay. And then my main question was, so if you come at this from the outside, in a way it seems to me the first question would be, is the dynamics described by diffusion, and then what if it is, what's the diffusion constant? So you told us the diffusion constant, but how far do your experiments test whether it's really diffusion? Yeah.
So I think to answer that question, one would have to do a very short time measurement on the time scales of microseconds, right? To actually see what happens in the short time when this initial spread of the phase occurs. That's inaccessible in our experiment because I remind you again, in order to actually see this attenuation due to diffusion, you have to separate it from the relaxation process. And so it's not feasible experimentally. We would not be able to tell the difference from relaxation and diffusion. The attenuation, this k squared d term in the attenuation would be too small. K squared d times t, where t is the time of the evolution, it would be too small of an effect. I don't know if that answered your question, other than saying that they can't do it.
Well, I suppose I imagine that somehow you need to measure the shape of a whole function. You know,
so the big part of e to the minus something that is consistent with e to the minus dk squared t. In a way, because they're doing, you know,
right, and k is a wave vector.
Wave vector, right?
And so the question is how much you're exploring, how much of the possible range you're exploring.
That's so in traceable they scanned, you know, three, how many k's you have, three or four? Yeah, maybe not enough range, but it's essentially if they filled in more data points, that would be.
Okay, so it is testing
that. Yeah, it's k squared t. Mm-hmm.
we tested it as a function of k, but your question is what happens as a function of t in time? How do you know in the short time whether or not it behaves diffusively? Is it one diffusive? I don't think I can tell experimentally tell the difference between diffusive attenuation and ordinary T1 relaxation in the short term. Those exponentials would be very difficult to discern to tell the difference about.
Yeah, okay, but I can see now that seeing straight lines on those graphs is basically a
what happens at what happens at very short time? I don't know.
So it's not ballistic, and what makes it not ballistic, you think, that these thermodynamic impurities?
Well,
then if you don't collide with anything,
it's a dense spin system, what do you...
Well, so, you might not get some plane waves, which...
Plane waves of what?
Spin waves.
But it's not an order, I'm not sure.
What is not ordered?
This is not ordered. This is a...
We have a spin system. We have a spin system.
Yeah, but still, it's translation in there.
No, it's not a lattice. A lattice spin system. Do you expect lattice spin system to have a ballistic transport? It's strongly correct answer.
That's a subject you have. Ballistic transport as a subject of debate.
No.
No, you didn't.
Certain systems can have ballistic transport.
Integrable, but this is a three-dimensional.
Also, the comment of plane wave is not something that I think is really possible with just spin diffusion. It's much more complicated than thinking of classical flip-flops. It's quite mechanically, you have much more complicated behavior happening even what I was implied by my model. Single quantum coherence, single spin coherence, than many multiple spin coherence, multiple coordinated states. So it's much more complicated than simple waves. Yeah.
So maybe I misunderstood something, but I understand that the theoretical prediction for this ratio is smaller by the order of magnitude compared to what you measure. If there is an or not for some directions.
So my opinion is if you get the order of magnitude in this any body system, you can do the thing.
But my question is it clear what is missing in theory, or at least some ideas what is not accounted theoretically in order to...
I'm not familiar enough with the theories to speak knowledgeably about what may have been overlooked. There's also a discrepancy across the theories, as you can see. And so I think that warrants a little bit more...
It's almost order of magnitude, no, factor five, which is...
So I should say, in all fairness, there's a measurement that was recently performed by the Myers group that showed a diffusion rate that's a little bit in better agreement with the number I've shown you in my measurements. But that wasn't done orientation. I was using my magnetic resonance force microscopy. And published that paper, I think, in 2006 or 2007. So the numbers are in a little bit better agreement. Another question? No, there's no more questions. Thank you very much. And